You're listening to Panel Borders. I'm Alex Fitch, and this is the first of two double-length episodes in which Duncan Knott and myself are talking to comics gossip columnist and graphic novelist Rich Johnston about his column Lying in the Gutters and his new book, The Flying Friar, which is about the 17th century monk St. Joseph of Copertino, whose life story, at least as fictionalized by Johnston, has more than a passing similarity to a certain superpowered boy from Smallville.
How did you start off doing Lying in the Gutters? I mean, it seems quite a specialised thing to do, writing about comics gossip.
Well, it's basically, comics is just like any other industry, any other entertainment industry. It's just got less money, but there's just as much gossip and snark and backbiting, possibly even more so, because there's, you know, less money and importance to go around. And initially, I mean, I was brought up, I was always reading like things like Private Eye and Media Monkey and the diaries and all the newspaper columns, and noticed there was just nothing like that for comics. So I used to, when I first got onto the internet about 94, I basically just nicked stuff out of British magazines and put them on the internet for American readers, claiming them as my own, exclusive stories that they hadn't heard of. And then eventually people started to send me the stories they'd heard of, and I was able to then research those and then report back. And in fact, I ended up writing for the actual magazine I used to steal from, and they used to get their stuff from me instead, although they paid me. I've never felt the need to pay them back for the initial theft, but it's just been going on since then. It keeps growing, that's the other thing. It's weird, just even though the comics industry has grown and shrunk and grown and shrunk, the audience for my column just keeps on growing. I've got quite a large audience now, and they just love their comics gossip.
A criticism that's been levelled at Newsarama recently, but I suppose has been the case with every kind of media outlet of comics, is that they just take the stories that basically let companies publicise themselves, and there's not a whole lot of depth to what's going on beyond that. So your column actually provides a space where more sort of in-depth and esoteric discussion of comics-related things can go on.
Yeah, well, basically, it is the antithesis of the press release. I don't run press releases, the occasional plug, but no, mostly it's all my big stories are all sourced independently from individuals, creators, people who work for publishers, or people who've been screwed over by publishers, and they want to get the truth out, and they come to me, and that's how I get these stories. Who hasn't been paid this week, or someone hasn't been paid for 6 months, they will come to me and say, "What do I do?" And I say, "Well, the easiest way is actually, you know, to let me tell your story," and then you'll find one of two things: either you'll get paid instantly, which does happen quite a lot of times, or secondly, you won't get paid, you're not going to get paid anyway, but a lot of other publishers will take pity on you and give you work. And that seems to happen as well. And then publishers get a reputation. If they're seen as not paying, then suddenly people stop working for them. And in the old days, I mean, this was always a big problem. Publishers would just not pay loads of people and just find new people to replace them. Mm-hmm. And that's getting harder to do now because they're getting more of a reputation. And I think my column's done an awful lot to help that situation. People know now, if you don't pay, you know, Joe Bloggs, he says, "Well, pay me or I'll go to Rich Johnston." And it works, and that has happened. I've been given exact examples of people staying, having that exact conversation and getting paid straight away. So it's useful to give like a little bit of that fear back to the publisher.
Well, I mean, you know, I only started reading your column recently, but you can see fairly quickly the good that you do. I mean, like the whole Marvel Dable Brothers situation I wouldn't have known about, you know, other than reading it via your column. And you'd think on the face of it, Marvel distributing comics based on a reputable fantasy company, that sort of situation would arise. It's, you know, it's almost inconceivable, but then you read about it in Lying in the Gutters and you think, God, you know, is anyone not corrupt?
Well, I've got to say Marvel were very good, I'm also aware that part of the reason Marvel were very good is because they knew that it would get to me. I was told that by one of the employees. And the Dable Brothers, I've actually been in discussion with them, and they've been telling me their plans about trying to pay people back. And I've been reporting on people who have been owed money and on people who've been paid. When the actual payment comes through, I report and say, "Look, so-and-so has been paid. Some other people haven't been paid." And then I keep it going so people know what's happening. And it does seem to have an effect. I mean, that's only one small aspect of the column. An awful lot of it is just making, you know, jokes at other people's expenses. It's leaking news that the various companies' press releases aren't ready to leak yet. often just going behind the scenes, finding out why things happened the way they did when it seems very odd, and it creating a kind of narrative between these. One of my favourites is always altered artwork. Whenever I get the original artwork for a project before it was published and then after it was published, and comparing the two and seeing what got changed and why they got changed, and you can draw some great conclusions about looking at certain bigotry within certain publishers. Publishers who would bolt at two men kissing each other on the cheek, kind of thing. Is there in the original artwork and not there in the final artwork? And why is that? Is there bigotry within the company? Are they just scared of advertisers or what is it? And so you can delve into all these kind of like value judgments as well, just from a simple panel that got published or one that didn't. It's remarkable how much you can actually squeeze out of such a stone.
I mean, was a sign of success when you went from people saying, oh, we better be careful what we say to you because we don't know who you are, to we better be careful what we say to you because we know exactly who you are. Imagine walking into a room and it all suddenly goes quiet.
it has, although weirdly, I mean, I seem to be able to keep secrets better than anyone in the industry. Really. There's stuff that I know about certain publishers which probably might have a really harmful effect, but it involves people's like personal lives and things, and when it gets to who's cheating on who or who's that, you can actually destroy families, that kind of thing, and that's the kind of thing I really don't want to. But because I've kept those kind of secrets, people do know if they talk to me. I never publish anything that the person I'm talking to doesn't want me to publish, kind of thing. If someone comes to me with a story, I'll listen to it all, and then I'll go back to them and saying, this is what I'm thinking of writing or going further with. And so I always let. So if people tell me something, I'll keep it a secret unless they want me to make it go further. And that. So as a result, I've got actually a reputation for being quite good, for talking with people. So it has changed. Initially, you do get the jokes. I walk into a room and then suddenly everyone goes quiet just for a second. But that's what it is these days now. It's more of a joke than anything. But it's quite weird because, I mean, some people do, in the industry, some people do absolutely hate and despise me. I've had death threats from professional writers and legal threats from publishers. But, you know, I'm still here. And it seems that I've now seemingly become in some way part of the very industry that I've been critiquing for so long, which is a weird position to be in, and not one I was actually expecting to be anywhere like that.
Well, I was going to say both you and your reputation and the possibility of death threats were immortalised in a CSI comic.
Yes, CSI Dying in the Gutters was particularly an entertaining version of my strange kind of twisted form of fame that's been kind of thrust upon me. But yes, it was great. I mean, I died in the first issue, had my autopsy in the second, and it was great to watch every single person in the comics industry being a suspect in my death. That, I thought, was probably the funniest aspect of it all. But yeah, they approached me, they were doing CSI comics anyway, they wanted to do one in a comics convention. Would I be the victim? And I, as you know, eager for all and any kinds of publicity that I am, the media-hungry whore that I clearly am, I said yes, and I was killed off very quickly, and it was a lot of fun.
Well, it's just a shame that the comics industry doesn't reflect the media as a whole, because CSI Miami is the most popular program on television throughout the world, but presumably the CSI comics don't sell in, like, you know, a tenth of the numbers of Batman or Superman.
Yeah, no, but of course CSI is rubbish. But but then, to be fair, a lot of comics are as well. No, I mean, certainly in the American, the English, the market, there's very set ideas of what a comic book is that will sell. It's superhero, manga, or kids. And depending on what market you're aiming at, those are the ones that will sell. And if you're not those, it's a little harder, certainly. But you can certainly find an audience and create an audience if you can push yourself and you've got the work that merits it. I mean, you look at people Posey Simmons or Raymond Briggs or Chris Ware, or Daniel Klaus. I mean, they're not exactly, you know, none of them are doing like superheroes or anything, but they're finding an audience for their unique voice, and they're doing very well from it.
Having looked at the gossip side and the news side for some time, was it a bit of a deep breath to go, right, and now I'm going to start writing comics as well, almost take that final step into becoming part of the industry, as you were saying?
Well, not really, because I've been doing it pretty much hand in hand from the beginning. I mean, I was self-publishing comics back in 1994, which is pretty much when I started the column. And it's just been on and off. It's just this time they seem to be selling a little more, and suddenly there's actual proper publishers willing to publish them. But no, I've always been writing and drawing comics, and then, you know, plugging them ruthlessly in my column, because as I said, it's what's the point of having a column read by so many people in the comics industry if I can't use it to plug my own work? I mean, that, I think it would be foolish not to.
Well, presumably your success regarding the column equals the kind of opportunities you've had in publishing comics, from things like X-Flies being self-published to Hold Up being published by Avatar. It's kind of reflected your reputation as a whole that you can get more avenues with bigger publishers to publish your genre work.
Well, I think so, but it means it's opened up small publishers to me. Mm. Big publishers do not want to work with me in any way, shape, or form. My name is verboten at DC Comics.
Really?
At Marvel, it would be seen as such a betrayal of various staff members if I was employed there.
With Marvel trying to be a bit cool these days.
I'm still the guy who reported all the Bob Harris gossip and rumours about some of their executives. So it's not very good for them. You know, this is the man who reported what a homophobe I am, and suddenly we're publishing his comics, are we? That's not going to happen. So no, but there are some opportunities. I'm hopefully pitching to Image Comics series next year. Which is, I mean, it'll be a small book, but again, it's a larger publisher, and they haven't got quite the history that some like Marvel and DC have, which I've always been able to exploit. So they're maybe a bit more open to me, but I'm not really in this to actually write and draw comics. I enjoy doing it; it's lovely, but that was never the aim. It's almost kind of like a spin-off of it. I mean, I work in advertising as a full-time job, and I love advertising. I love working in there. Comics is just a fun sideline in all its myriad shapes and forms.
So, working for advertising, you don't feel that being a comics gossip columnist, that's kind of like exercising the demons for working for some horrible corporations?
Some very nice and lovely corporations. it's just different muscles that I flex. And if I ever had to choose, I'd choose the advertising, because that's where my real love is. I love writing radio advertising. It's a passion of mine. And everything else are other passions. And it exercises different parts of my brain, my writing muscles, which help me overall. But I'm sorry to say, I'm an advertising man.
A subject that's come up a few times with people we've interviewed is, at the moment, they're publishing like Shakespeare adaptations, classic novels. I mean, there's always been classic illustrated. But a gap in the market is history comics that's not really been addressed, except for the likes of perhaps Warren Ellis' Cressy. But you've done The Flying Friar. How did your interest in that come about to start off with?
Random Googling and Wikipediaing, I think. He was just wandering around the internet looking at stuff, and I came across the story of St. Joseph of Cupertino, a man who could fly, and was actually, you know, witnessed through his life by thousands of people in his monastery and around the town as actually levitating around. I mean, this is independent reports by quite prestigious people who would talk about strange man who floated over everyone's heads. As I took that story, and I researched it for quite a long time, trying to get the basic historical facts as they were reported down, and then I just... It is historical, but then I just really kind of twisted it a lot. I gave Joseph the Flying Friar. He grew up with his best friend, who I decided would be the great-grandnephew of Martin Luther, Lux Luther. So you have a boy who can fly, his best mate's Lux Luther. They're growing up together, becomes his worst enemy. It's like religion versus science. I have Lux as a boy who's building all these flying machines. He wants to fly more than anything in the world. As he builds these great, enormous flying machines, which then cripple him. And this is a boy of science, and yet his best friend, a man of religion, can fly on his own without any apparatus. Which, you know, so you get envy, you get anger and denial, and you get friend versus friend, religion versus science, money, power, corruption, greed, and the Catholic Church in the 17th century. It taps into a lot of modern themes about the way people feel about religion today, and people feel about science today, and the way we relate to each other, and just plays them out in a very, very different world. And it's not historical fiction. It is historical fiction, but it's nothing really historical about it. It's just using something as a springboard to tell very weird stories from. I mean, again, you mentioned Krecky. It's quite a good historical book, but again, by putting a very modern voice onto it, it gives it a different feel, and I'm interested to see why I'm doing that. Some of the Shakespeare things, one of my issues is these are stories done as plays. You can see, you know, television and film as being an extension of that, filming those plays. So comics, I don't know, it feels like a step back. And I'm interested to see. I like the idea that, I mean, if you actually took a stage play, what could you do with that in comics? Is there something else you could do to give it another layer, rather than just doing the scene by scene portrayals? Why do you want to do this in comics? Comics is its own language, its own grammar, and from what I've seen, that hasn't really been used in these adaptations. And I'd like to see how you could use comics to full effect in telling those kind of stories.
You're saying that you've got Lux Luthor in the latest story, and obviously you're not DC's favourite person at the moment. I mean, do you ever find, and I hesitate to look like I'm putting two and two together here, but do you ever find some of the things you do through the column, you start seeing flavours of it coming out in the writing, or would we be wrong to read subtext into that?
No, in this case, not really. I mean, I have a love of comics and a love of comic stories and storytelling. The things I read when I was a child, the things I read now. And so it would have been my love from reading Superman comics that will have expressed itself in Flying Fur. However, I think one of the reasons for why the column has been successful is that it is written from a voice. This is not like some kind of a journalism that's completely bias-free. This is me just talk about the way I'm seeing comics and the way people talk to me. It's very much my voice in the column, and that's what I've been able to extend into all my other writing works, and so it's quite easy to get a leap from people. But no, I don't think any problems I've had with DC would have come out in the Flying Fryer. If it had, the opposite, it's actually my love for some of the characters that has emerged. Although it was, I think Newsarama did, they called Flying Fryer the best and ballsiest Elseworlds story that DC never published, and I kind of like that, but I don't think Paul Levitz would have.
Well, I mean, I was going to say, presumably the relationship or lack thereof between you and DC is what would prevent you from pitching it to them as an Elseworlds project in the first place.
I've only pitched one thing, I think, to Marvel, because they asked me to once, and it was never going to happen, but I just wanted to go, I found it amusing, I wanted to go through it, that process. But I never pitched it to a DC, but it's not really a DC comic. I mean, it's the flavour. I'm taking little flavours aspects of things like Smallville and Superman, but it's not a Smallville or Superman comic book. It's just using little flavours of those to tell a different story. So it would never have worked there. But I forgot where we were. Sorry,
why you weren't actually able to publish it as a DC Elseworlds?
Oh, yeah, it would. I mean, yeah, DC would not have published anything I'd written, even if they'd have wanted to. I mean, to say I've got a bad relationship with DC, that's not actually true. I've got a very good relationship with certain employees at DC, especially the ones who tell me stories. But clearly, from a corporate perspective, the column has had a lot of problems internally at DC, and I do get to find out about a few of those every now and then. It's when they have big meetings about me, and someone sends me the memo kind of thing, and it's just. It's remarkable. Here's me, a little guy writing some stuff on the internet, sitting in his London home, and suddenly over in New York, that necessitates a massive meeting at DC Comics about how to deal with me. But most publishers have just dealt with me. It's just by asking me either to not run something or run something a different way, or could I do it a bit differently. And usually, it depends on the story. But mostly, if it's not that important, I'm quite happy to amend things depending on if it's going to really affect someone. Urgently, there was some Superman artwork that went out onto one of the message boards that had some lady with her breasts open to the public, and that was quickly replaced, but not before, of course, I got a copy of it. And I had an email from the editor in question saying this could destroy my career. Please don't let these out. And so I didn't, because basically I'm a nice chap, and if someone asks me with a genuine reason, I'm quite happy to pull stuff. And a lot of publishers do work with me in that way. Some don't. And that's when you get strange, weird, twisted situations.
Again, possibly reading too much into The Flying Fryer. I'd never actually heard of The Flying Saint before your comic came out. Was it something that the church has covered up over the years in the same way that comics companies have covered up some of the stories that you've reported?
No, not at all. I mean, initially, back in the 17th century, yes, they weren't very happy about him. But 100 years later, he was made a saint, and he is the patron saint of pilots and things. He's definitely in the church's canon, as it were. I did have one thought at some point of doing a whole host of different stories about all these various different Saints and their various different abilities, you know, kind of like a Catholic League of America or something. Flying Throw is actually quite a serious drama kind of thing, and I didn't really want to ruin it for the sake of a cheap gag.
No one expects the Inquisition.
Indeed, but the Inquisition are indeed in the flyer, and they make a very good. And I, for a moment, I thought, well, let's get them played by. Let's make them look like Terry Jones. Actually, no, probably best not. Let's keep it straight. I don't want John Cleese and appearing in my own photos.
I suppose there's a Sun-style crusade for the column. Maybe see if you can get a patron saint set up for comics. You've got a flying friar. There you go. I mean, yeah, bread makers have a patron saint. Countries have a patron saint. Why not time for one for comics?
A patron saint for comics. I like that kind of thinking. I've no idea. What was his abilities to have been? To have, like, you know, ink appear on his fingers or be able to, repair an old classic comic book back to its original state. It happened. Oh, it's a miracle. This very fine condition is now a near mint of Detective Comics 27. You must be beautified and the Pope must make you a saint. That I like that. I should do some investigation. Thank you. It's a good thought.
Well, maybe someone, whoever the Catholic Church reveres as their ultimate illuminator of manuscripts, maybe he needs to be rediscovered and, you know, canonised.
I think so. I will research that the minute I get back to London, definitely.
Reading the kind of controversial stories about comics that have been doing the rounds of the internet last month, there's been two. There's the whole sort of Muhammad issue, where from the Baltic states, various cartoonists have had fatwas issued against them for upsetting the Middle East. And then at the same time in America, there seem to be quite a few college cartoonists who are drawing racist strips that are being pulled and then being forced to apologise for. I think there's been three in the last month. I mean, what do you think this is that's going on at the moment, that all of a sudden comics are now becoming a sort of hotbed of that kind of activity?
Well, one of the great things that cartoons do, for good or for evil, is they're very, very simple to read, very iconic, and they make a point fast, far more than text can do. So, and they're cheap to create and distribute. So, if you've got a point to make, you can make it so much better in a short cartoon than in pretty much any medium, and it will make an effect. Which means, if you have a racist message to distribute, it's a way of doing it. If you have any against any religion, again, it's such a powerful message because it's such a guttural, graphic, striking blow. I mean, this is why political cartoonists have always been so good in Britain, whether looking at people like Hogarth or people like Steve Bell now, because they make such an instant point that hits home. And it's only just reflecting that power in whatever message you want to put out there that you're getting the fuss now. It's so easy to distribute, so easy to get out there. I mean, the internet has really, really helped, because now you can be offended from several countries away just at the click of a button. And that is possibly the reason why it's having such an impact now.
Thinking of the power of the internet, perhaps in a different way, thinking back, the old-fashioned fanzines that would come out would be for a kind of small local audience, pretty much. And now you've got an internet which will reach everyone instantly with whichever pictures shouldn't have come out. But you've also then perhaps consolidated that sort of fanzine power in a few key sites: Silver Bullet, Newsarama, your column. I mean, is that overall a good thing, do you think, for the industry, or does it miss a bit of that kind of lots of little voices around the place?
I actually think there are lots and lots of little voices around the place, and where you always had some fanzines that were bigger than other ones, and some of them became things like the NME or the Melody Maker or the like. But you still now, there are hundreds and thousands of small sites right now, blogs, many sites, and they're all feeding off each other. I mean, even the big sites, things like Newsarama, it will feed off blogs. It's got a column which is pretty much just linking to other people's blogs. Again, if there's a good story happening somewhere and you haven't read about it and it comes to my attention, I'm going to, you know, grab that, put the story in my column, link back to the original. I totally disagree. In fact, I think the modern situation, you've got some larger sites, yes, but they actually feed off the smaller ones, and it becomes like a symbiotic relationship. And some of those smaller ones, some of those do become larger ones. I mean, Silver Bullet Comics, that's an example. That used to be tiny, and now that's grown in size, and that's going to that happens all over the place. Recently, Valerie D'Orazio, who used to work at DC Comics, she's been writing some incredible feminist critiques of modern mainstream comics, called Occasional Superheroine, and everyone has been linking to her because her writing is so good and she makes such great points. And now her blog is becoming one of the bigger ones, some of the biggest read ones in the comics industry. And that came from nowhere. So again, I think if you've got the content right now, the internet makes it a lot easier for you to grow in size.
Well, and also her blog is also coinciding with some sort of new sexism that's going on in the major publishers, with sort of tentacle porn appearing on the cover of Heroes for Hire, various DC comics having breast shrunk at the last minute, like you've probably revealed in your column.
I did indeed do that, yes. Well, I mean, it's... again, I don't think this is a new sexism. I think this is the old sexism. It's just people a bit more aware of it and are able to send huge screeds of protest, again, from several states away, because the internet makes it so much easier to be offended now. Whether for good or bad, that's not a value judgment, but you're finding a much more... I don't think there's actually any new sexism in comics. It is pretty much the same old, same old. And I think people are more sensitive to it. And indeed, publishers are reacting in certain ways because of this, and they're actually changing the work because of the actual response it gets. It's equal sexism. Just as Power Girl had her breasts shrunk before the comic actually was published, so I think one of the JSA characters had his penis dramatically withdrawn between the original solicitation of the artwork and the actual version of it. It's a great story to cover in my column, those kind of things, because you just get to show tits and boobs and dicks and whatever in some form in the column, and people always like to see those, especially if you can make some kind of strange twisted point about modern comics.
In the second half of this interview, we'll be talking about censorship, legal action and cause célèbre in comic books. For more info and links about this episode, please visit www.panelborders.com and click on the link marked blog.